Hello, folks. Kay Wisher here to remind you that it's that time of year again. Time for the Hacker Public Radio New Year's Eve show. For those who don't know, on New Year's Eve, December 31st, 2018, at 10 a.m. UTC, that is 5 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, we will have a recording going on the HPR Mumble server for anyone to come on and say Happy New Year and talk about whatever they want. We will leave the recording going until January 1st, 2019, 12 a.m. UTC, that will be 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, or until the conversation stops. Please visit hackerpublicradio.org to find all the details and links about how to set up the PC Mumble client, your favorite mobile app, the mobile server connection details, our Etherpad show notes, and the live audio stream if you only prefer to listen in on the lively banter. So please stop in and say hi, and maybe join in the conversation with other HPR listeners and contributors. It's always a good time.
This is Mintcast, a podcast by the Linux Mint community for all users of Linux. We record every other week on Sunday afternoons. Watch the Mintcast website for the schedule. Livestream information is at mintcast.org/livestream. We're in the Mintcast channel in IRC at irc.spotchat.org. If you see something that you'd like to hear about, send us email at mintcast@mintcast.org. Post at reddit.com/r/mintcast or post directly at mintcast.org. And now, here's the show. So welcome to Mintcast episode 298. We are creeping up on 300 here pretty quick. We got about a month now before we hit that number. And I am Leo, and here with me today is Bo.
Hey, yo, how's it going?
Got Tony Hughes.
Hi, guys.
We got Tony Watts.
Hey, everybody.
We have Moss.
Hello.
And we have Joe.
Hey, what's up?
How's everybody doing?
Well, not too You're bad.
Good. I'm fine.
Good stuff.
Let's all talk at once.
Staying busy.
I know, right? Yeah, yeah. As soon as I said that, I was like, yep, everybody's going to come in at me all at the same time. Trying to keep the banter from the pre-show. Just keep going.
We banter so well. That's a good thing about this show.
I know. It's when you add the structure of opening up the show that it totally kills it all. So I guess we'll go ahead and walk into our bi-weekly wanderings and kind of talk about the things that we've been messing around with for the past couple of weeks. And I haven't been doing a whole heck of a lot other than testing out Mint 19.1 beta in a VM. And I just last night, so I didn't get a full huge taste of it, installed it on my desktop as well. So this is the desktop that I'm on pretty much. If I'm on a computer, it's probably going to be that one outside of my laptop. So I took the plunge, ripped 19 out, and put 19.1 beta in the cinnamon flavor of that. And it seems to be going pretty good, though I don't think anything should be breaking, right? Other than maybe some cinnamon glitches here and there. Most everything is the same. The base is the same from 19. So I'm just testing out all of the new stuff. And we'll talk about that a little bit further into the show. But Joe, you've been busy.
I'm always busy.
I guess with work or with Linux stuff.
Usually both.
Just something all the time.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh.
Definitely.
Well, I am planning a long car trip. What I mean by long is 850 miles. So my kids will be in the car, and I want them to be entertained while we're going down the road, and they all have tablets. So what I'm doing is setting up a car server entertainment system. I've done something similar before, and it's all using tools I've used before. I'm just resetting it up and refining it a little bit. So it's going to be a local area network. I'm going to set one of the two devices that I have up as a hotspot, and it's going to be running Plex, which will provide movies and television shows that are on the device to my kids, or myself, depending. And then also I'm going to set it up with Easy Tether, which will allow, as long as my phone has internet, for the hotspot on the device to provide internet to my kids. And then I'm still deciding whether or not to put Mopity on there, which would allow me and my wife to control what goes through the car stereo. Just hook up the aux cable to the stereo and use our phones, and then we don't have to keep switching the aux cable back and forth between our devices. Now, the two devices that I have for this are my ThinkPad X120E, which is an older device, like 2011, so it might not be as performant as I would like, but I'm willing to give it a try. And the Asus Transformer T102HA, which is the more powerful of the Transformer devices. I'm kind of leaning towards the X102, because I might want to use my tablet, but we'll see. I'll get it set up on both and then decide. Oh, and I picked up a new keyboard from eBay. I wasn't even looking when I ordered it. It was just one of the Logitech K360s. And it turns out that it's a Japanese-English keyboard, which means not all of the keys are marked correctly. The Enter key and the Space key are oddly shaped. And there's like 5 extra keys which are unmapped to anything. But the 5 extra keys being unmapped is kind of nice because it gives me things that I can script to those specific keys. And we were discussing that before the show, what I should script to them. And my thoughts was I have the mute button on one of the keys. And then I might do VLC on another one. And then my VPN version of Chrome on another. But the guys were talking about maybe setting up the live cast with those keys. And I'm just not sure yet. Ooh. And I ordered 10 broken LG HBS 770s from eBay. And I've done this in the past. I'll order them. I'll get them. I'll take all the broken ones and I'll order them 10 at a time and I'll make 5 to 7 working ones, which is a good amount of profit considering that it cost me, you know, $40. And it's not.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. Do you go and sell those after you're done?
I really don't. But they do make great birthday and Christmas presents. And I like soldering anyway. So it gives me something to do. And keeps my hands steady. But this time, I ordered the 770s, but they sent 810s. And 810s have the retractable cords. So yeah, they're technically more valuable, but I didn't know how easy or hard they would be to work on. So the first couple, like with, you know, getting any new sets that I haven't worked on before, I ruined, which kind of sucks. But once I got the hang of it and how to do it, it's probably the easiest set of headsets I've ever worked on. And I have 4 working ones and one that has one side that still works. So if one goes out on one of the sides, I'll have a replacement for it. Now, something I really dislike about these is that the sides are not interchangeable. A right side has to go with a right side, and a left side has to go with a left side. But hey, 4 of them working.
Hey, it's pretty cool.
There you go.
And I'll make my final judgment on it depending on how long they last.
But I want to get back to the Plex server in the car. So
I was going to say the same thing.
Yeah, you're setting up a better home theater server in your car than I have in my house. What's the deal with that?
What do you mean? Why? Why not?
I just can't believe I can't believe I don't hear more people talking about that. You know, I've seen the Raspberry Pi and the Car Dash thing.
Right.
I've seen lots of Linux related car mods, but I've never heard of anybody setting up a Plex media server inside their car for their kids. And it makes sense. And so your kids can watch things on the media server in the back seat. It's actually a genius idea.
Well, everybody else wants to set up their Pi as an actual head unit and have it be the screen. And they want everything in that center portion. I'm planning on distributing. Yeah. I don't want anything video-like playing in front of the driver. I just want the kids to be able to access it.
That's so hilarious. That's great.
The kids are able to like pop open their tablet, log into or get into the Plex server. And where are the videos stored? Are they on like an external storage?
No. Well, on the X102, it has a 120 gig solid state hard drive that I just got from Micro Center. And then the T102HA has 128 built in, and then it's got 128 gigabyte micro SD card in it.
Oh wow! So are your videos kind of splayed across all of those things, or is it just on the second device you mentioned?
Oh well, I'm only putting enough on there to give them some choice and at least 8 to 12 hours worth of entertainment for whatever they choose, and there's more than enough space to do that.
Yeah, definitely. So you're just trying to stave off the "Are we there yet?" huh?
Yeah.
I bet it works pretty good too. I know my my daughter will usually just kind of zone into something for an hour.
That's a tech dad win. Very nice.
Definitely.
Thank you.
Cool. Well, then, Tony Watts, you've been dealing with some router woes. Sounds like.
Yeah, I had some trouble with. Basically, the family protection on my home internet, and what I think happened, I have a TP-Link router, and I had Family Shield. It's an open DNS, family, you know, parental protection, and I had the DNS settings set to use that. And I don't think I changed that. I think it reverted on its own back to use the ISP's servers, and that is not good. My oldest son, I have a special needs teenager, and he got onto some content that really he should have been protected from, and unfortunately that's how I found out. So I changed it back on the TP-Link firmware, but I'm concerned that settings can just slip because I, you know, like I said, I really don't think I made that change. I didn't touch it after I set it up. So I'm looking at DDWRT and OpenWRT. And I'm reflashing that firmware pretty quick.
As far as I know, if I remember correctly, and it's been a little while since I looked at this, OpenWRT got wrapped up into the fold with DDWRT. They used to be two separate projects because there was a fork early on, but I think mm-hmm. they've come back together unless something's changed now, since I looked at it. And it's been a couple of months.
My question on that is, was your former DNS to your Pi-hole?
No, this was just in the settings in the router interface. You can either have it set to use automatically your ISP's DNS servers, or you can specify them yourself, which I did. And I put in OpenDNS Family Shield servers. And actually, when I went back in to check it out and see what happened, when I set it from ISP back to servers that I specify, those servers were still there. So I don't know what happened.
Yeah, we had kind of back and forth a little bit on this in one of our chats, and I don't know. My only thought was like it rebooted, and it just didn't remember the configuration, because I deal with a lot of Cisco devices, and that's just my first thing, right? Like the setting didn't change. Oh, someone forgot to write mem.
Yeah, and I actually tried to reproduce that, and unplugged it and replugged it a couple of times, and went back in and checked just to see if any settings dropped, and. It stayed. I don't know. I'm scratching my head on that one, but I was meaning to go Linux based for the router OS anyway, and now I have quite a good reason to do it.
There you go.
Yeah. Back when I worked at Best Buy, I switched to DDWRT just because it was just kind of nerdy and I wanted to learn about it.
Yeah.
And it's kind of funny. I ended up breaking my router because of something I did wrong. But luckily, since I was still employed by Best Buy, I just returned it for another router.
Sneaky.
But other than that one time, I've never had any trouble. And honestly, we were talking in chat. I kind of just installed it, and then it does its thing, and I kind of forgot about it. I've never really done anything more than updates on it.
I've used it before.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's awesome. I've used it before. I had a piece of equipment that just kind of came into my hands that was a Wi-Fi extender. It wasn't even supposed to be a router. But you know, that's what I needed at the time. And so I was able to flash it and use it as a router, even though it was not a router. Because once you put DDWRT on it, you can use it as a Wi-Fi extender, which is what it was, or you can use it as a router or an access point, whatever you want. It's awesome.
That's right.
And that
I've
right there
that.
Is why yeah. I fell in love with Linux.
Yeah. But other than that, I haven't had a lot of time to tinker with stuff, but I do have a couple of those Micro Center SSDs that Joe mentioned that I picked up real cheap. And so I'm about to upgrade a couple of the PCs in the house, including my podcasting server. And then the other one's the just kind of main family computer. Both of them are on spinning drives, and they're pretty old computers, but I'm sure they'll be a lot snappier after upgrading them to those SSDs.
Oh, and thank you for that suggestion.
Yeah, man, you got it. Can't beat that, can you?
Nah, $20 for 120 gig SSD. Yeah.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
Ooh, that's pretty good.
They're coming down. $20 is crazy. Like, I knew they were getting cheaper, but wow.
Yeah, I don't know if I mentioned it before, but it's probably about 5 or 6 years ago I bought my first 240, I think it was, or 240 gigabyte Intel SSD, and I was pricing out, or it was like $160 too. I was pricing them out again. The NVMe ones are less than $100 for twice
really...
the space for 512 gigs. It's just insane the prices on these things now.
Yeah, that's really cheap.
Reminding me of my first 30 meg when I upgraded for my.
That goes way back.
Okay, I think that's it for Tony.
Yeah,
oh,
that's
yeah,
about all
definitely.
I got.
And so, Bo, it looks like you've been playing with Linux Mint 19, some KDE maybe?
Well, yeah, we had a suggestion on MeWe from Fugly, who said he wanted to know, since Linux Mint had dropped KDE as part of their normal builds, had any of us tried installing KDE on Linux Mint 19? And so I did it just because he suggested it. And KDE Plasma, I've ran it on my desktop before on the Archbox, and so I kind of knew what I was getting into with Plasma, so I could kind of compare what a vanilla install of KDE Plasma was compared to Linux Mint 19 installation of KDE Plasma. And I looked up some instructions, I looked up some like guides online, and everybody was saying you needed to add the Kubuntu PPA or the Kubuntu repository to your packages. I didn't need to do that. Honestly, all I did was apt-get install Kubuntu desktop, and it installed all the Kubuntu KDE Plasma packages on top of my Linux Mint installation, and then just log out and change your desktop manager whenever you log in to, from XFCE or whatever you had it set before to KDE Plasma. And then voila, just had to do some theme changes so it looked a little bit more like Linux Mint, and I was rolling. The only thing I've noticed is there are some differences in some of the widgets. Like, I didn't have a volume icon until I installed one. I didn't have it selected like the K terminal instead of the terminal I wanted to use. Just minor things like that that you may have had to adjust on any distro if you installed KDE. So I guess just for Fugly's information out there, it definitely works. It looks beautiful, and I can't wait to go back to XFCE.
Dumb question. Why does someone use apt-get when everyone's screaming to just use apt these days?
It's just habit, man. It's just habit. Can't stop typing
okay.
The get.
If there's a real reason, I wanted to know it, but apparently not.
No, there's
no,
really not.
Just muscle memory.
Yeah,
right, exactly.
A lot of that
yeah.
is what that is. And to be honest with you, the only thing that I've noticed that apt does over apt-get is color codes. It color codes the little bars that fly across your screen when you're installing packages.
Yeah, it gives a better progress bar.
But all the other, like apt auto remove, apt auto clean, all that stuff works just the way you'd expect it to, just everything but the dash get.
I didn't realize there actually was a difference. I thought whenever you typed apt-get, it was actually just calling the apt command for people that we're just used to typing get.
Yeah, it's slightly more than an alias, but like I said, all I can tell is a color code.
I might start trying just apt and get into the habit of doing that if it really is a little different.
Yeah, I think the big reason I went to apt is because HTOP spoiled me with their colors as opposed to just top. So yeah, on computers that I have, I use HTOP and apt. Just colors. I like colors.
Yeah, I've just recently introduced the older sysadmins at my job to HTOP as opposed to top, and I'm blowing their minds, man. It's crazy.
Yeah, you mean there's a gauge for CPU usage? Whoa.
But that's
okay.
All I
don't even know what top and HTOP is, so you're new on me.
Think like Task Manager, where it shows you CPU usage and apps
system
and memory usage and all that
yeah.
stuff. Yep. Yep.
Oh, you mean like Stacer?
I don't know that
no
one.
No clue.
Yes, I'm not sure what Stacer is.
See, we're all gonna teach somebody something today. All right, and Tony Hughes, you've been busy. You've got a list of things down here.
Yeah, I've got quite a few things, but I'll skip over the first one in the sense of we're going to be talking about it later. But I've been playing with the beta release of 19.1, both in VirtualBox and on the little Dell E6220 that I've got. I can't really see an awful lot of difference, particularly in the Mate desktop edition, because that's the one I tend to use most of the time. There's not an awful lot of difference that I can notice. I think a lot of the changes are under the hood, but I'm sure we'll talk about that again in a bit. I've also been looking at pricing up a brand new desktop system and going to the only Linux vendor that we've got in the UK called Entraware, and contacted them about putting in a piece of hardware. I want to get an IC dock for the machine, but currently the tower system that they sell doesn't have a 5.5-inch bay, but they're going to be introducing something in the future that will have a 5.5-inch bay, so I'm going to have another look at that in the new year. I've also been frequenting my local computer auction that sells old corporate laptops and desktop machines, and picked up a couple of things for friends so that they can give their children Christmas presents, but of old good corporate hardware rather than brand new off-the-shelf stuff in the local big box store, which will fall apart after about 18 months. So I've been having a look at that.
So you're the family computer pusher.
Yeah, usually, you know, if anyone has got any computer problems or wants any computer hardware, I'm the one that they come and have a chat with first.
Get them hooked young. Get it.
This particular commission came through my lug. It was and Raspberry Jam. It was someone that comes to the Raspberry Jam who asked me if I'd see if I could get a son a laptop. We've ended up getting a couple, one he knows about and one that he doesn't know about, but he wants to play with. It's one of the old Lenovo tablets. So, you know, the ones that convert into a tablet. So he's going to get a chance to play with that.
That's great that you have that near you. I'm jealous of some of the things you guys have around you. You have that, Tony, and then I think it was Joe and Leo mentioned they have Goodwill computer shops around them to buy used hardware there, too. I'm not aware of anything like that in the Atlanta area.
Right. Yeah, no, we're really lucky. The computer auction I use is about 45 mile away, but it's 45 minutes or so on a good day, as long as the roads aren't chopped up. But, yeah, I've been going there for quite some time. Probably about 12 years.
That's fantastic.
Over the years, I've picked up some really good stuff. The tower I'm currently using is a 5-year-old HP, or maybe even a couple of years older than that now, but it's an i7 that I picked up a few years ago, and it's been running fine. It's had a couple of upgrades along the way, as you do.
Sure.
So as well as that, I've been playing with MX Linux. I don't know whether anyone's ever played with that, but I was reading something about it working with really, really old low-spec machines. So I installed the 32-bit edition into VirtualBox, and after the install, I set it up to run with 256 mega RAM. It's a bit of a cheat because the hardware I was running it on was an i5 laptop, so it's not really a true test of old hardware. But it ran 5 on 256 mega RAM. So my next job is to install the 18 beta onto a Lenovo X61S and see how it handles with real hardware, 10 years plus old. So I'll report on that at another time.
It'll probably run just fine, honestly.
Yeah, well, it'll still be a dual-core machine, even though it's a mobile dual-core. But, you know, I think anything much older than 10 or 12 years old now is probably ready for the bin. So if it runs nice and smooth on that with 256 mega RAM, then, yeah, it's really good
stuff. Is MX related to Puppy or, what is it, Damn Small Linux?
No, it isn't. It's the old Memphis and Anti-X communities that came together to produce MX Linux. If you go on their website, there's a write-up about
it. Okay.
Yeah, it's quite a nice system. When you do install it, though, you've got to be careful because if you ask it to install the UK version of Linux of English or UK. On the keyboard and stuff like that, and for things, you actually get Ukrainian, not UK English.
What
you
in
have
the
to
world?
Make sure you have to make sure you tick the GB box for Great Britain.
Wow. Okay.
Because it's been developed in Eastern Europe, so. Yeah,
so they give their UK priority.
I ended
priority,
up setting
huh?
it up once, and I ended up with all this Cyrillics all over the screen when I first set it up, and then found out what the problem was. But yeah, no, it's a nice bit of kit actually. Runs nice and smooth. So if anyone's got old, I've had it running on a Pentium 4 with 2 gig of RAM, 2.8 gig Pentium 4. And it ran sweet on that. So it will run on old hardware.
I love that stuff. That's great.
Hey, guys. MX Linux is a cooperative venture between the Anti-X and the former Mepis communities.
Yeah.
It's really cool.
Yeah, it is. It's a nice bit of kit. And finally, I was at my lug yesterday, and one of the lads from the lug came with me to the auction couple of months ago now, and got a little Optiplex 7010, little micro tower, and he's upgraded it, stuck a couple of SSDs in it, and stuck a 1050 graphics card in it, and he wanted to install Windows 10, but there was a problem. He couldn't get Windows to boot for some reason, and then I realized what it was. It was getting confused about which hard drive was the Linux hard drive, and which was the one that was formatted for Windows. So once he swapped the hard drives over, we managed to get Windows 10 on it. It had a Windows 8 license on it, so we installed that, got that activated, and then did the upgrade, which still works, actually.
Yeah, I thought they had turned that off. That's crazy.
No, it's still going.
No, it still works.
But I think you could have installed 10 and then use the 8 license, and that would have worked as well.
Yeah, it probably would. I like to just make sure everything's activated before we do the upgrade to 10, just to make sure, because once you get the Windows 8 license activated, it just goes really smoothly. If considering it was it's an i5 machine, it was fairly slow to load the update on, but you know, considering I can get a Linux Mint install on and updated in less than half an hour, it took well over an hour just to do the update from Windows 8 to Windows 10. And that, like I say, it's on quite a beefy machine with an SSD in it.
Yeah, every time I see Windows updates come around, I have to roll my eyes because there's no telling how long it's going to take.
Oh, I know. It's cruel. but this guy at Milog, he's a journalist. He writes for tech magazines, and he's been asked to do an article using the Pi as a Steam controller. So he's installed Steam, and he's been playing with games on it. So his next job's to get a Steam controller working on the Pi.
Oh, okay. So, I guess I read that wrong. I was going to ask if he was turning the Pi into like a controller for Steam, or
Okay. That's the idea.
Okay.
You can run the Pi as a Steam controller, but the Windows box, he's going to put the actual Steam on it with the games, and he'll be able to stick that somewhere out of the way.
The Steam,
and just use the Steam.
The Steam Link software on Pi.
Yeah, it's the Steam Link. Yeah.
Yeah, Steam Link. Okay. Yeah.
That's really cool. If you didn't clarify that, I was going to give this guy the side eye from thousands of miles away, because he went to a Linux user group to install or to tinker with a Pi using a Steam controller, all from Windows.
No, it was mainly because he couldn't understand why the Windows wouldn't install on the machine. He's been running Linux longer than I have.
He needed to install Windows, but he didn't want to nuke his Linux, so that was a good place to go.
Right.
Yeah. And the problem was he'd got the drives in the wrong place, because Windows always assumes the Windows partition is on the first hard drive. So it was looking at that, and it was seeing a Linux-formatted hard drive and couldn't see the Windows-formatted hard drive to do the install on. So once we swapped the disks over and stuck the disk, Windows disk on the as the first primary disk, it was fine, and everything went as smooth as, you know, it was like ice. It was great.
Very cool.
And like I say, we got the install done. But he'd never come across that before. He couldn't understand why Windows wouldn't recognize that there was there was two disks in there, and one of them was formatted for Windows.
Yeah, there's Windows a good just reason. Has this idea that it's only the only operating system around.
Yeah, and of course Windows can't recognize Linux formatted hard drives, unlike the other way around.
Yeah, I see why he was scratching his head on that one. It really doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, and because he doesn't play with Windows that often, he'd not come across it before.
Cool.
So that's really what I've been doing this week.
That's a lot of stuff.
It was.
And Moss, you finally get to tell us a little bit about your Pi.
Well, I want you to know, Raspberry Pi is a gateway drug.
Yes.
So far, I've recovered an old keyboard from an old tablet and a mouse, an old wire mouse I had laying around, because who uses wire mice these days? USB had to buy a Wi-Fi dongle, had to buy another Wi-Fi dongle because the first one only worked with Windows or Mac drivers. USB extension cord for the keyboard, 7-port USB 2.0 hub, powered. In fact, it turns out to be so powered that it runs the Pi if I plug it in first. I don't even know if I have to plug the Pi in for power. And then after you get it all booted, which takes 15, 20 minutes, you discover that you need a new Pi, preferably a 3B+. This Pi 1 runs at the speed of evolution. But I've made progress. Also, I've had a lot less time to work on it with the holidays and having to make more money to get ready for my trip to Atlanta, because I can't work for several days there. I have my annual trip to Atlanta to... it's essentially a family reunion of chosen family. Let's see. I also discovered, well, if anyone wants to chime in on the Pi, you all know about this, the new newbie around here. My Mulvad started acting funny, and I couldn't figure it out. And it didn't matter what I was booted. And then I found out my Ethernet was plugged in to my Pi. And my setup for Mulvad, for some reason, did not want to automatically recognize that I was running Wi-Fi on the laptop. I plugged in the Ethernet cable, and everything works fine. Yay. It's a setup issue. Isn't it fun being a noob?
that's the first step to getting good at stuff, though.
Yeah, you know what they say. Experience is directly proportional to ruined equipment.
There you go.
My fire cover came in. You know, I wanted an orange one and all that. We couldn't find... The vendor that made the one that came in blue that became my wife's fire, we could not find the equivalent, and we still haven't. So I have this orange one. It doesn't fit very well. It's a harder plastic rather than a gel, and it doesn't really cover all the edges and corners right. So we're going to just hang around until we can find. the one like my wife had, has. Let's see.
So did you order another one and it still wasn't right?
We ordered another one. It wasn't the same type exactly.
I was just going to say, at this point, you got like 17 covers for this thing.
No, it's only two so far.
Oh, okay.
But we ordered three fires. Well, I got the original one free from you guys, and then we bought one for my poor cousin, and my wife decided she liked it, so I let her have the one with the blue cover, and then had to order a cover for mine. And so, yeah, it sounds confusing. I probably talk about it over, and you think I bought 15 of them.
You got bad luck with these covers.
Yeah, you do have an Alexa, and then you have, sorry for the A word, and then you have three Fire tablets between you and yeah, so you're an Amazon thing over there, huh?
Well, actually, not really. I've had tablets. I've got an LG Tab, LG G Tab F or whatever that is, and it works pretty well, but it's a dual core, and it's a little on the slow side. I've got an Asus MemoPad 2 that I'm just going to get rid of because it's slower than my Pi. Someone said, well, gee, the Amazon Fire tablets work really well. And someone in this group says, yeah, I've got one. I'll send it to you. And we did discover that, yeah, for the most part, they run faster. We're trying to make them run more like Android tablets. We've got Nova Launcher on all three of them. We're not so much hooked into the Amazon mainstream, but boy, do we get a lot of boxes on the front porch.
I think Moss and I are about to start the Amazon podcast, the Amazon cast, if anybody wants to check that out.
Amacast.
No. I don't have enough money to do that.
Will that
time? Every episode, we remind you to buy laundry detergent.
So
yeah, absolutely. There you go. Use your pod.
Is that going to ship out to our podcatchers within 2 days of recording every time?
Yeah, absolutely.
So anyhow, and the last thing here is the Uber app has apparently been upgraded to the point where it's making it difficult to run on my Moto G5 Plus. Every day there's at least one, sometimes five or six calls that I accept the call and oops, something went wrong, and I don't get the call. And so I bit the bullet, and I ordered a X4. Probably should have gone for a Z, but I didn't have the money. And then the first one that came in, in the refurb process, they left the testing apps on, and somehow that disabled the phone function. Remember that Nakuno phone we were talking about last week with no phone?
Yes.
Well, I had one of those. I sent it back. The guy told me after I'd already ordered the label to return it to him that I could have just sent it to Motorola and gotten a brand new phone. Here's a trick for you out there.
Yeah, really.
Buy a refurb phone on eBay. They run about $160, $170, maybe $175. And if they don't work, you can get a brand new X4, which is a $300 phone.
Nifty.
Huh.
I returned that one. I got the refund. I've ordered another one, and now I'm waiting for that to show up and hope.
So I never thought about this. If you're an Uber driver, your ability to do your job is heavily weighed on, you know, how modern your phone is. Does Uber,
exactly.
Do they have any kind of compensation program or anything to try to give you
discounts kidding?
Or anything like that?
I'm about to use an F word here. They don't do nothing. They don't pay for your gas. They don't help you with your the fact you're driving your car into the ground if you're doing this full time.
Yeah.
And you have to pay all the maintenance. Mm. By the time you figured in your maintenance costs and your gas costs, I'm making, on average, as a almost full-time Uber driver, $4.30 an hour.
Mm. Yeah, they it's because of the whole contractor thing, right? That's why they get away with it.
Well, they don't get away with it everywhere. New York and New Jersey actually sued them. And I just had a cat jump up on my chair. Get down. New York and New Jersey successfully sued them and got them to pay minimum wage plus their fees. Now, they may have reduced the fees. I don't know the ins and outs of that. And that was a successful lawsuit. They've already won that one. California filed a similar lawsuit last month. But the only way to get that in Tennessee is if we do something silly like unionize the drivers.
Not in Tennessee, anyway.
Yeah, in London, the mayor of London took away the Uber license because classed them as unlicensed taxis. So there's a case going through the courts in London at the moment.
Well, according to the news, Uber has gotten a temporary settlement on that and is functioning.
Yeah, because it's still going through the courts, they've got a stay of execution until it actually gets heard. But
they had a bigger,
still not actually had a legal definition of it yet.
They had a bigger problem in the UK with the fact that Uber wasn't totally vetting their drivers. And they had a number of sexual and physical assaults by the drivers on passengers. Damn. So that was a big black eye.
Yeah, there has been problems with that.
Yeah. Haven't heard of that here, per se. I won't go into the problems I've had because,
Yeah, I've heard some
Anyhow,
horror stories.
Anyhow, this is also not Ubercast, so let's move on. I'm done.
let's circle back to Ubercast. That sounds like it could be gold. But yeah, let's continue.
See, all right, so we've already created two podcasts out of this one single podcast.
Yeah,
Amazon Cast.
One segment. Yeah.
Don't forget Ubercast.
Would have to be a video cast. Have it turned on in the back seat while you're driving.
Dash cams, yeah.
That's what you need to do, Moss. Start a YouTube channel. You'll make way more off the YouTube channel than off of Uber driving. Just, like, film the people in your car.
No, we're going straight to HBO with this.
I'm sorry. You'll have to find someone else. With my autism, every time I have a bad experience and I remember that bad experience, I completely relive it. And I'm shaking just thinking about it.
So then don't watch your YouTube channel. Everybody else
right,
will.
Don't watch them.
Just post it.
I believe there's also a privacy violation there.
Hey.
Yeah, probably.
They gave away their rights when they signed up for the Uber app.
Yeah. Somebody's watching.
You'll have to prove that in court, I'm sure.
Anyway.
No, you will.
I think we're going a bit off topic now.
Yeah, let's
on
move
to
on.
To the news.
Let's do some news, yeah.
So we've got some really interesting stuff coming out for us this month. Clem has said that we're looking for a late December release around Christmas time for Linux Mint 19.1. So I wanted to open it up and kind of let us all talk about some of the stuff that is going to be coming down in all of those. And I guess since it's the main flavor, we'll start with Cinnamon. Have y'all been able to play with it much?
I've had a little play with it. That was the one I actually installed on real hardware. I put it on the Dell 6220, I quite like it. I'm not a big Cinnamon fan. It's just seems a bit too Windows-esque for me, and I prefer the Mate desktop. But it seems stable enough considering it's a beta. It installed fine and. It seems stable enough. I like the fact that when you open an app, you get the Windows-like little line underneath the icon on the taskbar just to say it's open. And when you go over it with your mouse, it brings up a little screen to show you that you've got an active window rather than taking a big chunk of your taskbar. But I think a lot of the other changes seem to be under the hood, so to speak. I couldn't see much major that I could particularly notice. I don't know what other people think.
Yeah, I think the modern launcher down there at the bottom is going to be the biggest thing that you notice. And yeah, I hate to say it, but it looks a little like Windows 7. So it kind of brings that feel to it, which is depends on who you are, I guess. It's I never use the either of the two taskbars down at the bottom. I think in a previous show I mentioned I kind of make it look like a Mac, though I don't really use Mac at all.
Top taskbar people.
Yeah, top taskbar for the win. I don't know. It needs to be up there, and I think it was GNOME 2 that made me do it. I blame GNOME 2.
I'm sorry, the poll figures are in, and you're losing.
That's okay.
Yeah.
That's okay.
I'm a bottom taskbar person.
See, but that's the
we do of have it. A poll on these things on the MeWe page. People, go visit.
I've polled, and I know I'm losing, but that's the beauty of Linux Mint, and that's the beauty of Linux in general. Is that right? I mean, you get these tools, and there's always some switches and toggles and drag things that you can just kind of make it your own. And yeah, so I usually
that's right,
do.
Yeah.
The about that. Taskbar down at the bottom, though, one of the first things that you're going to notice is going to be that. But if you launch, or if you want it the old way, you can just pop open the welcome screen. Just, you know, hit the super key, type in welcome, hit enter, and then under first steps, you'll see you can choose traditional or modern. So if you just absolutely hate the new one, you can swap back to the old one in just a couple of clicks. So it's easy to do. And as Tony was saying, yeah, most of the changes are going to be under the hood, and a lot of them came out in Nemo. So that's just going to be their file manager. Some really cool, just, you know, configuring your columns, and there were some XApp improvements. And one of the other things that I noticed, and we were talking about apt a little while ago, and I mentioned apt auto remove, that is now part of the updater GUI in Update Manager in Linux Mint. So you can see all the previously installed kernels, and you can remove them, or you can do really kind of whatever you want to with all of those kernels back there.
Well, you know, guys, I don't do betas simply because I'm trying out so many distros all the time that it's not really helpful to do the beta. I'm still waiting for OpenMandriva 4 to come out, so don't have to play with their alphas and betas on that. I hope what they fix in Cinnamon is their window switcher, because in Mate, it looks almost exactly like Cinnamon on the window switcher on the taskbar. But in Mate, you can just drag an app from one window to another. In Cinnamon, you have to right-click, open up the window manager, move it, and then go to that window, and then switch back to window one if you just wanted to move something out of your current.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I don't mess around with it. And so you're talking about like moving an app from one desktop to another desktop?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, from a long time ago, and it's probably a vestige of using Windows too much, but I never got into actually using multiple desktops. What I ended up doing was just buying bigger and bigger resolution screens so I can fit more crap on one screen.
When you have bad eyesight, you can't do that.
Oh, I've got horrible eyesight.
I need as big a print on the screen as I can get.
Okay, I believe you on that one. My glasses still pull me through.
That's a feature that I think I've never really, you know, gotten into using either. It is funny though, the people that use that like religiously use it, but I've just never been one of those people.
Yeah, I've tried to get into using the multiple desktops. What is it? Control, Alt, Left, and Right will switch between them automatically. I think I too spent too long in the Windows ecosystem, and I just never can get used to doing it that way.
Yeah.
Well, but in Mate, all you have to do is use your mouse and click to the other desktop. You've got the four on display down there. Right. You can change it to two or three or six or eight, but you just click on the other desktop.
Right. And
is there not like a widget you can add to the Cinnamon desktop that would give you that same feature where you can click between the two?
Yes, but like I say, you have to, if you want to move an app from one desktop to another desktop, you have to right-click on the widget, open up the window manager, move the thing, click on that window, and then that minimizes it again, and then you have to go back down to your widget and click on the desktop you just cleared up that you wanted to move something else into.
GNOME does it really well.
Just too many steps, huh?
Yeah, in Mate, you just click on the window manager, the app on the window manager shows which app is there, you just drag it over, and that's it.
I'm
still in the window you wanted to clear up.
Yeah, I'm in Cinnamon right now, and it looks like the easiest way to do that is to right-click on the title bar of the app. But if the app is minimized, you have to bring it back up. But there's a move to another workspace, and then you have always visible workspace, only on workspace. But it's in the top task, or whatever you call that, the title bar.
Hmm. Well, it looks like you can also do it from the bar at the bottom, or in your case, the top. You just right-click on the application down there, and it says move to another workspace.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, I've janked mine up. I have the Mac like launcher down at the bottom, and I don't have it. Doesn't show me the running apps at all, except for on that bar on Plank.
All I'm saying, people, use Mate. It's simple as pie.
I actually, I prefer Mate. The way they manage that, anyway, yeah.
I use Mate on my smaller machines.
Yep, I'm the same way. I use Cinnamon on machines that I have a good graphics card in or has a more modern Intel CPU.
Exactly.
And Mate on, or Mate on everything else, yeah. So the last really cool change in Cinnamon is, and it has to have been like 3 or 4 episodes ago. I think it was our very first episode where this group was on. But I was complaining about the fact that we only had a mint wide dark, and it just had that that green. And don't get me wrong, I love me some lime green, but not for my folder icons. So I was hoping to get an orange, and that was kind of the itch that Ubuntu scratched for me years and years ago. But they finally added in aqua blue, brown, gray, orange, pink, purple, red, and a bunch of other colors as well. So that's the other big change that we're going to be getting in 19.1. So mostly graphical changes and nothing under the hood, because remember, Mint 19 is going to be based on 18.04 for its entire lifetime, so there's not going to be any huge under the hood changes that are not GUI related. So that'll be really nice.
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to point out that when this gets out of beta and is a real release, right now, you know, I've got 3 different Mint versions on my laptop here. I was going to make Mint 19.1 Cinnamon. I'm going to change that to the XFCE. So that way I've got XFCE and Mate in 19, and I'll have the Cinnamon on my LMDE.
I was hoping someone was going to bite the bullet and do the upgrade. I imagine it'll work just fine, but Windows has scarred me for upgrades for life.
Can you do the upgrade right now to 19.1 from 19?
I think you can, but it's certainly not supported.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, I wouldn't update. I wouldn't upgrade to a beta.
I may give that a whirl just for kicks, because I got to go to a new hard drive anyway. So that could be one of the last things I do before I move.
Just install 19.
And I will answer that question. I will answer that question for you, Leo, because I always wait till upgrade just to see if they figured out how to upgrade yet. Ubuntu ruined me on that a long time ago. But so far, Linux Mint and KDE Neon have been great at just running the update.
Yeah, definitely. I know Linux Mint has a good rep for that, but just the nightmares.
You know, to go way back on the taskbar comment that you made earlier in the conversation, Leo, I think there are a lot of Windows 7 holdouts out there that haven't wanted to make the jump to 10, and it sounds like the graphical changes are going to make Mint more comfortable, or Cinnamon more comfortable to someone coming from Windows 7 if they decide to go Linux instead of going from Windows 7 to Windows 10. So that's a great thing in my book.
Yep. I mean, that's what got me over in the first place. I mean, I started with Ubuntu just because I wanted Linux. But as soon as I was like, it's not really exactly what I want. You can't really, once they hit Unity, you couldn't really customize it very much. So my next step was Linux Mint. And then I distro hopped for a little bit and then came back to Linux Mint. And then outside of Mint and Solus, I think I've just stuck on those two. And it's been Linux Mint for the past couple of months just because we've been really focusing on it for the show. So it's yeah, I don't know. I like it. I like it a lot.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people have probably had your same experience too.
Yeah, most of the listeners to this show are probably quite experienced Linux users and Mint users. But one of the things that Clem always says is, if you've got a working system and it's your only system and it works and you're not really that interested in, you know, the very minor changes that the 19.1 can do for you, you're probably better off just sticking with 19, so that you don't risk anything happening to your system when you do the upgrade, particularly if you do the inline upgrade rather than a clean install.
Yeah, that's the biggest reason I do a clean install. I'm trying not to break anything, just save my files.
Yeah.
But the last thing I'll say on this news item, because we're kind of sticking on it for a little while, but I guess it's the Linux Mint podcast, right? I mean, it's Mintcast, so. But is Matei and XFCE get every single one of the changes that we've talked about up to this point, except for the Cinnamon-specific changes, which are the Cinnamon taskbar down at the bottom and the Nemo changes. Everything else will be coming down to the other flavors of Linux Mint 19.1.
Yay.
And we have some Android Trojan news. Moss, you kind of dug that one up for us.
Yeah, we found there's an Android Trojan that steals money from your PayPal account even if you have two-factor authentication on.
Oh, no.
You have to download the app. It makes it look like it's a battery saver app. It was first detected by ESET in November 2018, combines the capabilities of a remotely controlled banking Trojan with a novel misuse of Android accessibility features to target users of the official PayPal. The malware is masquerading as a battery optimization tool, granted they can change it at any time. It is distributed via third-party app stores. It's called Optimization Android, and it shows a little battery symbol I'm used to seeing. After being launched, the malicious app terminates without offering any functionality and hides its icon. From then on, its functionality can be broken down into two parts. One services targeting PayPal. You go to PayPal, it's use enable statistics. And, of course, everyone wants to enable their statistics, right?
Oh, of course.
Well, that turns it on. So, during the analysis of WeLiveSecurity.com, the app attempted to transfer 1,000 euros. However, the currency used depends on the location. Whole process takes about 5 seconds, and for an unsuspecting user, there's no feasible...
Ouch.
They have a video. We have it linked. There's a video on the website showing how it works.
That's a really good reason, unless you know what you're doing, not to use third-party app stores.
Yeah, this is the public service announcement portion of the podcast, I guess. So when it comes to Android, if you're going to have something nasty happen to you, it's only going to happen if you intentionally install something for the most part. And yeah, as Tony just said, steer clear from third-party app stores. Even for things in the Play Store, even if it's not really malicious, if you see anything there that says it's going to optimize your battery, speed up your performance, even antivirus stuff is, I don't know how necessary that is, but yeah, those are not apps you want.
No, who's downloading files on their phone? Like, I mean, I get like the odd PDF here and there or something like that, but
I do.
I don't know.
Files on my phone? I use BT Sync to get my audiobooks onto my phone.
Oh, but those are MP3s. Like,
yeah,
they're not
files.
Like, executable binary type. Well, okay, yeah,
true.
I was too broad. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, this would be like if you were using like the non-Android Google Play Store, like if you install like a third-party store.
Yeah, F-Droid, yeah. Stuff like that. A lot of people do it simply to get away from the Google ecosystem, the Google overlords.
Which, you know, when we were talking a lot about our Android or our tablet hacks a couple episodes ago, yeah, I mean, some of these stores they're obviously used legitimately in most cases. It's just they're not watched as closely as the actual Android store. So I think it's probably a good tactic to just never download any of those things that say they're going to speed up your device or something like that. It's probably BS. I would just not trust those types of things.
Give your app a cursory Google before you install it.
The app that says it's going to add a 32 gigabyte SD card to your phone programmatically.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Yeah.
Download some RAM.
Yeah.
It's funny because it's the same tactics that we used to see when I worked at Geek Squad. It's like, you know, speed up my PC, fast PC now. There's always those type of applications that people would mistakenly get on their computer, and they swore it happened automatically, but I'm sure they got a pop-up and they thought this was gonna help
their
$200 PC. Right,
yeah,
exactly.
Oh, you know they clicked yes about 14 times. I didn't click anything.
Right, exactly.
I just turned it on and it was like this.
You have no idea how many times I've heard that.
That just says that we should... Sorry. That just says that just clicking on everything as you go through without reading what the box says is not a good thing.
Nobody reads the EULA.
Yeah, that's the takeaway.
Yep.
Yeah, but even when I'm installing Android apps from the official store, as soon as it says, can we have access to this, that, and the other, unless I really, really, really need that particular app, I go, nah, it's no good, this, and I've been it most of the time, unless it's something that I really need.
Good man.
Yeah. And, you know, that's another thing, too, is it's not just reading it, but it's also, do you trust this person that is saying this? So, you know, it's not just reading it and saying, okay, they're asking for access to this or that, and that's all they're going to do with it. Like in this case, you know, it was a total lie. They're asking if you can send information to them for their testing purposes, but that's not really what saying yes was doing. So even if you read that, you may say, oh, okay, I know what that is. But in reality, this app was lying to you. They were being disingenuous. So it's reading and it's also trusting. You know, I wouldn't say yes to anything unless you trust the source.
Well, it can also happen with reputable apps. I mean, let's just dial the Wayback Machine a little bit here to, 4 or 5 years ago, and ES File Explorer. Great app when it first came out. The company got bought out by another company, and the next thing you know, it's complete and total bloatware. It's popping things up in the background every 5 minutes, and it's almost completely unusable.
Yeah, that's a good example. I had used that and trusted it for a while, and then had that experience directly after it changed for the worse.
Okay, we should probably move on.
Yeah, let's do that.
Well, speaking of then, Bo's added some stuff about Epic Games releasing a new platform. So what's that about?
Well, the only reason why this is Linux news is because of all the recent Steam news that we've gotten with Steam Proton and all the Linux support they've been putting out. But Epic Games recently announced that they are going to launch a game store competitor to Steam, or similar to stores like Steam. And they don't say that it's going to be supported. They don't say they're going to support Linux. But they say other open platforms. They say it's going to be available on other open platforms. That could just mean that it's going to be available on Android and Windows. We don't really know. Since I put that in the show notes, there was another news article where they said they were going to be releasing game engine development tools for, you know, people that may be interested in building games for their platform. And it used the quote, all platforms. Now, all can't actually mean all. I'm sure they're not going to do like a OpenBSD, you know, Epic Game Store, but I think they're really beating around the bush here that they're a competitor to Steam, which is probably at this point the biggest, you know, game store on Linux, and they keep using terms like all platforms and open platforms. I mean, I think it's pretty safe to say that there's going to be some sort of a version of this that's going to run on Linux. Also, Epic Games, are they the people that do...
They're the Fortnite people, aren't they?
Yeah, they're the Fortnite people. So, I mean, I think this, I don't play Fortnite, but I think this would be huge if it did actually be released on Linux, and if there was a Fortnite was available natively on Linux due to this.
Oh, that'd be it. I think Linux would win at that point.
I think this is complete speculation, but I think they are intentionally beating around the bush. They could just come out and say what other platforms mean. They could say what all platforms mean. They're being intentionally misleading by the way they're wording this, so I think there's a good chance we could see some Linux related news from Epic in the future.
I'd be really excited for it. You know what's going to happen? Here's what's going to happen. They're gonna create a Linux runtime and they're gonna call it Neutron, and then we're gonna be able to play all the Epic games, and they'll have all the tweaks baked into Neutron.
That's exactly what'll happen.
Yeah, you guys heard it here first. All right, and so speaking of porting stuff over to Linux, now this is not something that has been stated just yet, but that's my thought on this next Microsoft Edge story. So, Joe, you had some info on that, right?
Yeah, well, basically, if you listen to any tech-based podcasts, you know that Microsoft is looking into getting rid of Edge and changing everything so that Chromium is the back end for their new Edge browser. What this kind of means, if they end up doing it, is that the Edge browser will be open source. So anything that they do for Chromium should be available upstream, which means also that Edge browser should be available on Linux. And now what I also think this means, because Microsoft has had so much trouble breaking into the system on a chip environment, is that they will start moving into Chromium OS or Edge OS, and that will allow them onto smaller devices.
Ah, okay.
If you can't beat them, join them.
Right.
I think this is going to be kind of cool. I don't know. There's kind of two sides of this coin, right? I mean, Chromium is going to get really good really quickly once Microsoft starts contributing to the code base. But the other end of that coin is Chromium is going to get really big really fast, which means that Firefox might be the only real competitor,
well,
right?
No. Just because it's happening to Chromium doesn't mean it's making it into Chrome.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah, definitely. But even so, that would just... That's a lot, yeah.
And they could fork.
That is very true. I don't... The way that they were talking in the article and the way that I've heard some stuff around the internet doesn't seem like right. That's going to be the case, but
they don't want to do a hard fork, because then they lose all the development that's going on from everybody else on the planet, which is kind of the problem that they're having with Edge. They don't have enough people developing for Edge.
Right.
Well, they did announce that they are doing a Mac version, and it's only... Since it's a Chromium base, it's only a small step from there to a Linux version.
Exactly. That was really my big motivation for you know, being cheeky like that. Just it'll be here.
Yeah.
So is Microsoft adopting Chromium as their engine, so to speak, for Edge, and they're still going to produce Edge, or
yes.
Are they dropping Edge? Okay, that's
they're,
what's okay.
Yep, no, they're,
the
first they're,
yes, they have a new logo that looks like Edge with a Chromium look to it.
Right,
at
it's
going to
be Edge,
it, right?
With a Chromium backend.
So it's going to look like Edge and run like Chrome.
So it's going to be, and it'll probably use Bing as its default search browser.
Well,
oof.
If
that's,
it's
that's
bundled,
the killer app right there.
Yeah, if it's bundled with Windows, then yeah, it's going to use Bing.
Of course.
Which is horrible, yeah.
Yeah.
Thereby bringing Bing to Linux.
You know, this goes back to the malware on Android story, but it's connected to Edge. Whenever Edge first came out, whenever I was working at Best Buy, and people would buy those Roku devices, and the Roku setup process would say, go to roku.com/setup. And some scammers had set up their site so that if you did a Bing search for roku.com/setup, it would go, their site would be the top result. And whenever you clicked on it, it looked like a Roku site, and it would tell you, okay, to finish your setup, call this 1-800 number, and you call it, and of course they say they're with Microsoft, and you got all this crap on your computer, and they need access to your bank account or whatever. So it was just because Bing had such terrible search results, they allowed this, you know, scam to happen. And so, I mean, the onus of that is definitely, like we said before, on the users that they shouldn't have trusted this site, but they were using Bing on a computer that they probably had just bought, and Bing was the default search engine, and so they had no reason to disbelieve that this was the right place they should be. And ever since then, I've just always hated Bing.
Yep.
Yep.
Well, even on a Windows system, even if I'm using Edge, I always install or set the default page to be Google.
Right.
You know, for the search engine.
The only thing Bing is really good for...
Just Bing's not as good anyway.
Right. The only thing Bing is really good for is their video search. That's it.
Yeah, I kind of give it a go.
I misspoke a bit earlier when we were talking about third-party app stores and stuff like that, and I was indicating, you know, go with the Google Play Store and whatever, and I guess what I really meant to say is Google Play Store is going to have protections in there from harmful things that aren't necessarily vetted in third-party app stores. Third-party app stores are great if you're really careful and know what you're doing. You're not necessarily going to get the same level of protection with a Bing search, and it being controlled by Microsoft. You have every reason to think that you know you're going to get legitimate results and
right.
safe results, and every bit as much as Google. That's just, you know, hasn't really been true in reality, or at least in the case you're talking about.
Right. I think what you just said is exactly what I couldn't articulate. there should be, and we should have implicit trust there because Microsoft's a big company. But obviously, there are cases where they've been neglectful in protecting users from those malicious search results. And I would just hate to see that type of, I would just hate to see that type of culture and environment bleed its way into a project like Chromium.
Yeah, at the same time, you don't want it to be all Google either. We need more options than Google, so it's tough.
Definitely.
There's DuckDuckGo. You know, that's coming along.
That's what I use. I mean, I use it, and it works 95% of the time, and I hate to admit that, like, the other 5% of the time where I'm like, it's just not coming up, I need to find it, I'll swap over to Google. But, I mean, for 95% of my searches, I have it set in Firefox to default to DuckDuckGo, and it finds what I need. And, I mean, like, I'm looking for some pretty obscure, you know, this broke in Linux, and I need to fix it really, really quickly. DuckDuckGo will dig it up for me, so I've been very happy with it overall.
Yeah, I mean, you got to figure Google's in the search business for how long now, and even Microsoft with Bing has made some missteps that we were just talking about. So this is not an easy job to do. So 95% of the way or anything close is really very impressive.
All right. Anyway. So, yeah. So we have some a couple of articles from Bo, one of them being the Opera launches built-in cryptocurrency wallet. What in the heck is this?
Yeah, I just saw this headline. I thought it was fascinating. So moving on from the year of the Bing desktop, we have Opera launches built-in cryptocurrency wallet for Android. And all the negative drowning in our tears, Bitcoin miners news as of late, Opera thought it was a good time to launch a Android cryptocurrency wallet. You'll be able to use Ethereum in their wallet, and I think you can actually use their wallet to purchase more Ethereum, and the plan is they're gonna do more cryptocurrencies in the future.
Cool.
I just thought it was interesting, you know, all the talk about whenever cryptocurrency was like booming last year, everybody was saying like this is going to get rid of ads on the internet, the new thing will be like websites will ask for your permission to use your computer for mining cryptocurrency while you're browsing their website, and that's going to be the new way of the future, the way websites are going to be able to pay for themselves without having to do AdSense. And and then of course whenever it went from $19,000 back down to $4,000, everybody kind of gave up on those hopes and dreams. And I think it's kind of I think maybe is it a ray of sunshine in the sea of clouds, I don't know, but Opera's still has faith that cryptocurrency is going to be the way of the future. So I just thought it was an interesting article. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say cryptocurrency is not going anywhere, though the timing is probably not great. People are scared of crypto right now because everything is crashing.
Right. Yeah, I'm still holding some stuff, man. Still holding.
Yeah, I got a little bit in there. A lot less than I used to.
Yeah, as I say, I got out a lot whenever I saw what was happening, but I left a little bit of faith in the system and hold a little bit. Adobe Customer Care has said that there is not enough demand for a Linux build of their Creative Suite products. This was posted on, I think, Veronix, but even since I posted it here in the show notes, there was another article on Linux Journal about it, and they've made a comment section on the Adobe website just for quote unquote voting for Adobe CC products on Linux. And so basically,
vote.
Right, exactly. We've got the link in the show notes. If you follow this link, it will take you to what looks like a comment thread. But if you just like the top comment, they consider that a vote, and you can even post a comment, saying why you would like to see Adobe Creative Suite products on Linux. I thought it was an interesting conversation though, because I think there's a big culture within the Linux community to just not use Adobe Creative Suite products. I mean, we have things like Krita and Raw Therapy, and there's lots of great alternatives to the Adobe products that I think that they've just been around. It's not like gaming on Linux where a lot of that stuff is brand new. A lot of these Adobe replacements have been around for years and years, and they're actually really good. And with video editing, I actually prefer doing it on Linux as opposed to using a PC or a Mac with Adobe products. So I think this is kind of an interesting conundrum. Do we even want Creative Suite products on Linux, or just let them have their thing and we've got our open source stuff here?
I'm going to put out there that, yes, we certainly want Adobe Creative Suite just simply to spur on the development of the open source products. I mean, it's something to look up to. It's something to compete against. And because they're isolated on Windows and Mac, I think we can kind of forget about what they're doing a lot of times and, you know, look over the wall every now and then and be like, oh, that's a nice feature. Maybe we'll do that. But overall, I think it would be a really good idea to bring them over.
I think that's a good point. I didn't think about from the competitive aspect of it, because I would hate to see, like, if Adobe's products came to Linux and then these developers that have been working on things like Krita for years just lose their following because people are just switching to CC. But at the same time, I don't necessarily know that that would happen, because it would bring so many Adobe users into the Linux ecosystem, and, you know, maybe there would be that whole tide rises all boats scenario. So we just have to see.
I think it will be. I mean, no one's going to stop using Krita. I mean, Krita's free, and you just throw a fiver at them every year or something like that, right? No one's going to just drop a few hundred dollars on Adobe Creative. So, well, not everybody is going to drop a few hundred dollars on Adobe CC and, you know, just, oh, they got Linux support now. All right. Time to drop all the open source everything and just move over.
The way CC works now is you pay monthly. It's like $4.99 or $9.99, or it keeps going up from there. Yeah.
Even better. Yeah. So even less people will move over.
Well, the big thing here is that people are not moving to Linux because it doesn't have my this that I use on Windows.
Yeah.
Or it doesn't have my this that I use on Mac.
Bingo.
We need to have the thises there, but we also need to have the Kritas and all these other things that we know work better and are free.
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah, you nailed
it. Absolutely. Cool. So we got a couple more little updates from our gaming episode a couple episodes ago. Really quickly, number one is the Steam Controller version 0.4.6 is now released, which should give you a little bit better performance of your Steam Controller on Linux. And they also have an experimental version that was compiled in C++, which should give you even more performance, but it's still experimental, so, you know, don't blow your Steam controller up just yet. And then we have the addition of DXVK version 0.9.4. I swear these guys are updating at the Mintcast cadence. Every couple of weeks, they come out with a new one, so every couple of weeks, I have to let y'all know that there's an update to DXVK. And click on the link in the show notes, because there are a good handful of games that have gotten some improvements via that update. So definitely check those out. And then our last news item of the day is Jellyfin. So Jellyfin is one of these things that is... it was born out of frustration, I think, because we had Plex that was born out of XBMC, and it became kind of the de facto proprietary movie watcher service from anywhere. And then Embee came out of frustration with Plex. So what was funny to me is that Embee has now gone the way of Plex. They have closed their source. And so now we have an alternative called Jellyfin that has been forked from Embee. So yeah, we're three layers deep at this point. So what do y'all want to take bets on the name of the next one?
Jellyembee.
Who knows? That's a good one, though. But so just real quick.
Isn't that Jellyfin?
It very well could. I have no idea. We'll have to go check it out. But Jellyfin works with all of the Embee apps and everything. So if you've bought or if you've installed Embee apps on your various devices and you just remove Embee, replace it with Jellyfin, it will work exactly the way that you expected it to. And until the Embee devs break their API, Jellyfin will continue to work with those Embee apps. So keep on trucking. All right, so... and since we got our show running just a little bit too long, we're going to put some of our Linux innards on to the next show. But I think it's going to make it even better, because what we had in store for you right now was Docker. We were going to kind of cover what Docker was about, why you wanted to use it, and some of the use cases that Joe and I have been tinkering around with. And then I was going to dive into a little bit of Flatpak and how it's different. You know, don't call it a container, because it's not. It's a sandbox. Can be. be a container, but we're going to head into some of that stuff as well. So expect a shorter news segment, but a longer Linux innards segment for episode 299. And we'll probably throw in some snap and app image flavor in there for you as well. So this will give us some extra time to deal with all of that. So moving on from Linux innards, we'll hit some of the vibrations from the ether. So these are the emails that we've gotten, or the posts on the mintcast.org website, or Reddit posts or whatnot. These are those that have come to us over the past couple of weeks, and we just want to make sure that we talk to everybody about some of this stuff. So Moss has the first one.
Are you sure about that?
Yeah, because I think it rolls into the earthen thing. Yeah.
All right. Well, Jack at tinypeapot.co.uk said in episode 296, somebody was unhappy that EarthenView was not available on Linux. Perhaps XNView is a reasonable substitute. And we have a link to XNView. I've never heard of it. I will go look at it after this show. We had a lot of response last week from the crew here that, yes, we do love EarthenView. And I literally wrote EarthenSkillion and asked him, are you going to port this to Linux? And he responded. He said, hi, sorry, I can't promise a native version. I have no months/years of free time. Winky face. It can be used with Wine. It runs pretty well. I responded back, of course, that was not the response I was hoping for, but I thank you for a quick personal response. Maybe you could open source the code and let some of us Linux types at it. And he responded very quickly again, maybe someday.
That's great that he responded so quickly, though.
Definitely. And it works pretty well in Wine, right? Yeah,
that's what he says. I haven't tried it.
I just wanted to double check on that. But I don't know. It just reminded me that it was a few shows ago. That roadkill cat has a soft spot in my heart. And then we have the next one, Kogoman at Zoho.com. This is a bit of a long one, but after listening to a few episodes of the podcast, my hard drive died. The host who does hard drive recovery for a living says you should never use SSDs in a RAID system. Since the failure mechanism of an SSD is dependent on the number of writes, if an SSD dies in a busy RAID system, the other drives will be close behind and are likely to die during the resilivering process. Though there's a chance you will get through the resilivering, you can see the danger there. I suggest that if you must use SSDs in a busy RAID setup, you should buy an extra drive. As an example, let's use a three-way RAID system. So he goes on to say, put drives 1, 2, and 4 in and run it for a month, then add drive 3 and run it for a couple of months, and then remove drive 1 and install drive 2 and run it for a month. So what he's trying to get at is not having all the drives have the same amount of wear on them so that they don't all accidentally fail at the exact same time. And this is something that when I dealt with big NAS systems and I dealt with a couple of different SANs, the way that we combated this was we never bought the same manufacturer, or at least we didn't buy a huge amount of the same drives from the same manufacturer. So we would go, like, you know, if it was a 12-disk system, we would buy 4 Western Digitals, we would buy 4 Seagates, and then 4 HGSTs, and then we would sprinkle them in. Not really randomly, but we wanted them all to kind of be separated enough that if it turned out that all of the Western Digital drives were just a big pile of steaming crap, then, you know, they would die, but yet your RAID system, or at least whatever you were running, didn't totally blow up in your face. So another recommendation for this SSD thing is to go with more than one manufacturer, and I think you might be a little bit better off. But yeah, good suggestion. And we got one more from, and I'm going to butcher this name, and I apologize in advance, but Jane Sass? Jane? Maybe?
Probably Jan Sass. Yeah,
see, I knew it. So Jan, Jane, John, I'm sorry. I apologize. They write in, hi, I've been listening to Mintcast for a long time and enjoy the new lineup. Thank you. I was wondering if any of you had any experience with the Asus Tinkerboard. I love the specs, but have been having difficulty with booting an operating system on it. I was wondering if you had any experience with the Tinkerboard. I think the problem I have been having is with the monitor I've been using. A fan. So I remember we talked about it a little bit, not in the pre-show, but I think it was just in between somewhere. Does anybody remember that one?
No, I've never used the Tinkerboard, so...
Yeah, I'm looking at it now. It looks really cool, though.
I think I've had a similar issue with the Raspberry Pi, and it probably is not the same thing, but it might give you something to go off of. You had to, in the Raspberry Pi, you had to change a configuration file. I think it may have been Xorg, where you configured the exact resolution and output, like DisplayPort or HDMI or whatever, to make sure that on boot it didn't have to recognize the monitor. It was just given the monitor configuration, and it would load that up and maybe have a better better experience.
I guess the easy way to troubleshoot this would be booting it without the monitor attached, and then hooking up the monitor and seeing what happens.
That might not be a bad idea either.
Or booting it without the monitor attached and seeing if it is recognized on your network. Well, I guess if you haven't set it up yet because it won't boot, then that won't work. But if it's if it's wired, that would work.
Exactly.
And I don't know if the operating system that you would load onto the Tinkerboard would have SSH turned on automatically, but that would be a way to test without the monitor.
Definitely, and that'd be a way for you to get in and tinker with those configuration files if you needed to do that too. All right, and I think that was it for all of our vibrations, so we'll head on into the last segment of the show, which is we just have a few things that we might want y'all to take a look at, and the first one we have is from Joe. Go for it.
Who? Oh, me.
Yep, yeah, you.
anyways, the Steam Link. Yes, they stopped selling it, but there's still a lot of them out there. I mean, for a while, you could get them for $2.50 plus shipping. So I have one. And I read an interesting article on putting Kodi on the Steam Link. So that's what I did. It's actually really simple to set up. You grab the files from GitHub. You put them into a location on a USB stick. I think it's under Steam/Steam Link/apps. And then you plug it into the Kodi box, you restart, or not the Kodi box, but the Steam Link box, and you restart it. It installs the app. You pull the USB and restart it again, and there you go. It's all set up. I did put the Plex app from inside the Kodi store onto it, but I really didn't like the performance of that particular application. I haven't done any further testing yet, and I kind of need to. And that's all I really have on
it
so far.
Right?
Yeah, it works great. It installed. Kodi came up. It was running smooth. The only issue I had was with Plex and streaming.
That's awesome.
And Joe, you were able to find one of these on eBay?
Oh, no. When they were still selling them towards the end of the run on the Steam Link, they were selling them out from Steam. You could order them from Steam and like $2.50.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
Are they all sold out now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they quit making them. That's why they were trying to get rid of the ones they had.
Here's the deal. I bought one right before the sale went off. And so it was $2.50 to get the thing, but it was like $7.99 to get it shipped. So
right.
The shipping cost more than the actual box itself. But for $12, it was pretty worth it.
Right. In that $10 range, a little box that will, you know, let me stream my Steam games to other machines and play them from there, that's still worth it to me.
Exactly. And since everybody's recommending, oh, you can now do this on a Raspberry Pi, well, yeah, but it's still $30 more.
Right.
But
very cool little box.
I love mine.
I wonder how well the Zero W will do the Steam Link.
I think for that, it's totally a bandwidth issue.
Yeah.
Just a network bandwidth issue. But if it can do it, it's just a streaming thing. So it would probably be okay.
I'll have to check it out one of these days and see.
Yeah, I've still got my Pi 1 running that Plex app, so I figure I might just nuke it and try that out, tell you
how
it went.
Why nuke it? Just grab a different SD card and swap.
That is true. $4? I can handle that.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool, and then Bo had some check this out as well.
Oh, I just thought this was hilarious. So I've got a link in the show notes to it. Use Reddit in Terminal with RTV, Reddit Terminal Viewer.
Did Bo leave us?
Oh, I think I'm still here. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah. You had some check this out, right?
Oh, yeah. I was talking. I don't know what happened.
Okay.
So I have an app. I've got a link to it in the show notes. It's use Reddit in the terminal with RTV. That's Reddit Terminal Viewer. So you can view Reddit.com via terminal. And my plan is to use this at work, so it looks like I'm working when really I'm just looking at Reddit. And I just think it's great that this thing even exists. So there's a link to it in the show notes. You should definitely check that out.
I'm going to do this just so I can stay in terminal more often than I already am.
I love these like terminal versions of applications that are so obviously all made right. to not run.
And then
in terminal.
Moss had some. Check this out too.
Why, as a matter of fact, I do. What a thought. I'm here. I've been playing with the show notes here. Abhishek at its Foss. Its Foss has been a service that we've used quite a bit on this show. Basically, Abhishek is in India writing about Foss stuff for Indians, but he has a lot of good stuff and he's on top of things. He wrote a tutorial about using a simple tool for converting audio files from one format to another in Linux, and we have that linked in the show notes. And he's always writing cool tutorials. Check out itsfoss.org and have a good time.
That's really cool. I'm still using FFmpeg to do a lot of those conversions for myself and like paste video files together and all that kind of cool stuff. But I'll check his out because if it's easy, I'm happy with that. All right, and that's it for the Check This Out. So we just have the one single announcement that I think we have every single episode, which is next episode will air at 2 p.m. Central Time on Sunday, the 30th of December. What do we want to do some predictions on that show?
Yeah, I think we should. Just figure out what's going to happen in the next year.
I'm definitely going with Edge
cool.
on Linux, I think. I'm going to preview that one. That's going to show up in that show.
I'm going to go with Edge OS.
Ooh.
The year of the Linux desktop on Windows.
There's way too much Microsoft talk in this podcast. All right. And then the other thing was that we're going to be doing a bigger episode of Linux Innards as well, so we can cover all that Flatpak and Docker stuff. All right. And then cool. Before we leave, we just wanted to make sure that we acknowledge some of the people who make Mintcast possible. That's Kay Wisher for the PiCaster, a Raspberry Pi that streams each episode as we record it, the folks over at Hacker Public Radio for the Mumble server we use to communicate, and the Linux Mint development team for the fine distro we love to talk about every couple of weeks.
Thanks, Clem.
Thanks, Clem.
Thanks, team.
This has been another episode of the Mintcast podcast. The show notes for this episode are at mintcast.org. You can send us email at mintcast@mintcast.org. You can find more information about Linux Mint at www.linuxmint.com. You can follow both Mintcast and Linux Mint on Twitter, @mintcast and @linux_mint. Thanks to Mark Blasco at podcastthemes.com for our theme music, and thanks for listening to this episode of the Mintcast.